Chapter 37, The Klan Rises. By the end of 1973, the Klan had grown dramatically. Not only were we reaching and recruiting many new people, most of them in their 20s or 30s, but we made sure that the quality of each new member was high. The media had carefully created an image of the Klan as violent, ignorant, and hateful. To overcome that image, we stressed to every member that he had to be super legal, with a responsibility to stay out of trouble, not only for the sake of his own well-being, but also for that of his Klan brothers. We viewed our organization as having a sacred mission to secure the survival and advancement of our heritage and rights. Our members knew that acts of violence against minorities were not only wrong, but actually hurt our cause rather than helped it. Anytime white-on-black violence occurred in America, it received national media coverage for days or weeks, while millions of white victims of black violence received only brief local coverage from the media. Thus, the media made it appear that hatred and violence were intrinsic to the white rights movement, whereas the civil rights movement was represented as a force for love and brotherhood. We were in the middle of a psychological war, and our enemies had a tremendous advantage through their domination of the mass media. Many young whites learned by experience how much damage integration did to their neighborhoods, schools, and communities. Its injustice became obvious to anyone who attended a heavily integrated school or who saw the decline in his neighborhood as it went black or Mexican. Young white people were anxious to stand up for themselves, but they simply did not know how. The Hollywood portrayal of opponents of integration as violent or as cross burners actually encouraged that kind of behavior among young whites desperate for some sort of way to defend themselves and stand up for themselves. In any social institution, young people were never permitted to have white rights groups or exhibit any kind of white pride. While black pride and solidarity were officially sanctioned and encouraged. The only response depicted on television or in movies against integration was physical resistance. Some alienated whites imitate the violent anti-black behavior they see on television. Such behavior only reinforces the image the media has created of violent and hateful white racists. Of course, only a small fraction of cross-race crimes were white crimes against blacks. And whenever a black-white altercation ended with the white winning, the media depicted it as a racial incident. Any fight between blacks and whites in which the blacks won simply resulted in a police report or rare media coverage, if even that. If blacks dragged a white child off his bicycle and beat him up, it was just kids fighting. But if a white child did a similar thing to a black child and the black child had to go to the hospital, it became a nationally spotlighted racial incident. Jesse Jackson and a few sports stars, along with dozens of news cameras and crews, were likely to show up at the hospital room for a photo opportunity and a round of anti-white propaganda. That pattern still goes on today. On rare occasions, a criminal white person will hurt or kill a black, and invariably, it will be on the news for days, accompanied by statements by both white and black political leaders decrying white racism, tearful interviews with family members, and drawn-out coverage of their trials by a morally incensed media will follow. As shown in my Race and Society chapter, the reality is that acts of criminal violence by whites against blacks are extremely rare, while acts of black brutality, rape, and murder against whites are commonplace. As I began to receive publicity for my Klan stance, many children who attended integrated schools wrote to me complaining bitterly of their experiences. From their letters, I could see that they had a right to be angry. Many of them had been intimidated and attacked by blacks. They were forced into an environment of primitive behavior and criminality. They were taught in school that their ancestors were exploiters, while blacks were taught pride for themselves and hatred for white people. After appearing on national media programs, I began to receive dozens of letters a month from white students all over the nation, many of them writing about horrendous conditions and terrible incidents that people never hear about in the mass media. Over the years, the number of similar letters has increased to the point where I receive more today than at any time since the beginning of my public activism. I explain to those who write to me that they have the right to defend themselves if attacked, but that doing illegal things just makes matters a lot worse for themselves, their families, and their friends. I tell them that the last place they really want to be is in jail, outnumbered by the very worst of the blacks. I also stress that our movement is not about hatred, but about love for our traditions, heritage, and freedoms. I knew then, as I do now, that the only way we could build a lasting movement was not on hate, but upon a deep and abiding love of our people and their highest ideals. As my notoriety grew, nothing bothered me more than being referred to as a hater or part of a hate group. It is the integrationists and multiculturalists through their misguided programs who are creating a climate of racial hatred. What do the liberals think that a chronic recital of white evil against blacks does to black attitudes toward whites? The media dwell on historical enslavement of blacks, discrimination against blacks, lynching of blacks, and the killing of black civil rights leaders. Blacks are being taught to hate whites, a visceral hatred that's often expressed in their epidemic violence toward white people. At the same time that blacks are taught to hate whites, whites who simply want to preserve their own rights are called haters. Whites who want to live in a safe and decent neighborhood of their own heritage are called haters. Whites who want their children to attend academically excellent and safe schools are called haters. Even by simply discussing the realities of racial differences, we are called haters. Yet, it is a failure to recognize and deal with those inherent racial differences that produce the climate of hatred in the first place. The kids who are most embittered are so for good reason. They have been forced into integrated schools where they have suffered unjustly. White children who are in all white schools have a lot less animosity and very often very good feelings toward blacks and other minorities. The whitest areas of America have the most liberal attitudes toward blacks and other racial minorities. If I had my way, I would stop these insane programs of forced integration, and the result would be a lot less hatred and animosity between the races. If people truly want to end racial animosity and hatred, all they need to do is recognize the differences that God and nature made and simply cherish and preserve those distinctions. Instead, the liberal elite espouse an artificial equality that can only cause friction. Furthermore, by allowing massive non-white immigration and by encouraging the welfare breeding of vast numbers of more primitive and violence-prone people, society becomes permeated with far more barbarism, crime, and hatred. I took part in many debates at LSU, and a number of professors invited me to visit their classes. One argument I heard repeatedly was that recognizing racial inequality leads to brutalities such as the Holocaust. I pointed out that most of our founding fathers did not believe in racial equality, and they built no alleged gas chambers. I would also point out that by almost any measure, far more people were murdered in the name of human equality than any other doctrine in history. In the name of equality, the Jacobins of the French Revolution murdered tens of thousands of the finest and most cultured people of France. In Russia, China, the nations of Eastern Europe, Cambodia, Vietnam, and elsewhere, many tens of millions were killed in the name of equality. Equality is a religion of hatred and envy. When its false doctrine doesn't produce equal results, it enforces the equality of people by repression or even murder. Jewish supremacist groups such as the ADL, Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith, are the most notorious users of the word hate to describe those of us who oppose their hypocrisy and misanthropy. They love to call us white supremacists, but what we really want is not to rule over or be supreme over any other race, but to simply live in our own societies by our own values, opposing and oppressing no one. Racial separation makes a racial oppression impossible, and racist hatred becomes a lot more difficult. On the other hand, Jewish ethnocentrism is truly supremacist in the classical sense, for Jewish extremists don't want to simply separate and have their own society in the way that we whites almost always seek the company of our own kind. Jewish misanthropists don't want to simply be apart from us. They actively seek to rule over us. As this volume has shown, Jewish supremacists hypocritically seek to break down the ethnic pride of the people among whom they dwell so that they can exert their power over the people among whom they dwell. They accuse us of the ultimate evil that they associate with the Holocaust, genocide. Yet they seek to defile and destroy our traditions, our history, our culture, and ultimately even our genetic existence, which is certainly an accurate description of genocide. Their final solution is to destroy the racial heritage of the people who they believe have so wronged them. And the genocide of our race is occurring right now on a worldwide basis. They call us haters for exposing Jewish hatreds and Jewish supremacism, but they are never called haters for their incessant accusations of Christian hatred or Christian intolerance against Jews. We are attacked for believing in white intellectual superiority over blacks by the Jewish-dominated media that unabashedly promotes the idea of Jewish intellectual and moral superiority over Gentiles. Jewish supremacists portray as narrow-minded bigots those whites who oppose race mixing between blacks and whites, while their own organizations run multi-million dollar ad campaigns and Jewish publications against Jewish intermarriage. And Israel, by the way, has laws that prevent the legal marriage between a Jew and a non-Jew. We are morally chastised for wanting to protect our borders from massive non-European illegal immigration, while the Jewish media praises Israel, a nation that allows only their own heritage to immigrate. Jews constantly cast guilt upon Europeans and Christians for the Jewish Holocaust in the Second World War, but they call us haters for simply pointing out the leading role of Jews in the early days of communist Russia, the communist regime that murdered tens of millions of Christians, not only in Russia, but in much of Eastern and Central Europe. In the 1970s, the Jewish-dominated media frequently talked about white terrorism, while the FBI reports showed that the leading terrorist group in America during this period was the Radical Jewish Defense League. The JDL committed the most bombings of any group, as which can be shown by official FBI surveys of terrorism at the time. When I became active in the Klan again, I hoped that the fascinating character of the organization would be able to attract media coverage. Hollywood used the image of an evil KKK to further the objectives and image of the civil rights movement. But in using that device, it made the Klan fascinating and newsworthy. In January 1974, I made a media breakthrough on the nationally televised Tomorrow Show with Tom Snyder. From then on, I found that many in media could not resist the ratings opportunities of having an outspoken Klan leader on their talk shows. Even some of the most dedicated ideological Jewish opponents of mine simply could not resist both the challenge and the probability of higher ratings. Still today, a number of talk shows invite me specifically during their rating periods to boost their audience numbers. One of the most interesting shows I did after my Tomorrow Show appearance in 1974 was the Stanley Siegel Show, which was aired live in Nashville. He later moved to New York. Siegel had watched the Tomorrow Show and decided to take an approach unlike Tom Snyder's. If he couldn't argue with my facts, he would ridicule me. I knew he was a tough interviewer, and our Klan den in Nashville kept a file of clippings on him, so I was ready with a good response to any personal attacks he might make upon me. He kept trying to argue my points and kept losing, so near the end of the show, he let loose what he thought would be his trump card. "Mr. Duke," he said, "isn't it true that the reason why you and other Klansmen are so opposed to blacks is because you white racists feel sexually inadequate to black males? Aren't you just jealous of their sexual prowess?" I stared him down and responded, "You know, Stanley, only a sick person like yourself would even think it in those terms. Let me ask you a couple questions. You say I'm mentally ill, but isn't it true that you have been treated by a psychiatrist for 10 years? Isn't it also true that you once dove naked into a huge vat of jello? And Stanley, speaking of feelings of inadequacy, why is it that you, pointing to his raised stool, that you have your stool raised up so that you can look as tall as your guests? Are you feeling inadequate?" "You know," I said, "sexual inadequacy as compared to Negroes would never cross my mind, but I can't understand why it crosses yours. You know, only a perverted little Jew like yourself could come up with something like that." Siegel was so shattered he could barely finish the show, after which he immediately ran off to his dressing room, crying like a baby. I even felt a little sorry for him, but he had really asked for it. Those programs were satisfying on a number of levels. I reached millions of people with the truth about race. I break down old stereotypes about the Klan, and I must confess that I enjoy the challenge. When I was in the Klan, it was great to walk into every show, every college speech as a hated underdog, and then turn the tables on my smug opponents. Most of the media really believe their own propaganda because they have never really heard both sides of the racial issue and exposure of Jewish supremacism. They are simply intellectually unready to handle me. Many of these hosts are masters of the spoken word, and they know how to use humor, a turn of phrase, or even commercial breaks and camera techniques to their advantage. But the basic truth of our position and the easily revealed hypocrisy of our opponents are advantages that cannot be effectively refuted despite their clever repartee. I also frequently have a bit of fun. At a college speech at Vanderbilt University in Nashville, Tennessee, in the question and answer session, a loud Mal, the Dwight girl, came up to the microphone, pulling with her, by the hand, a black man. While I was speaking, she rubbed her hands through his hair, put her arms around his neck, and kissed him repeatedly about the head and neck. When she finally came to the microphone, the audience grew completely silent. As she held his hand, she looked at me and said sarcastically, "Well, Mr. Duke, what do you have to say about this?" I just ignored her, looked at the black fellow, and said empathetically, "I'm really surprised to see a gentleman like you with such white trash." The audience laughed and roared for about 3 minutes until the woman had to sit down in shame. More media presence also resulted in more college speaking invitations. At that time, I received an honorarium of about $1,200 per speech, which really helped us get the equipment we needed for the movement. Starting from almost no funds, we had steadily built up our book stock and office material. We made every dollar go a very long way. I bought a used printing press and plate maker and learned to print. Soon I printed, at very low cost, the thousands of leaflets we distributed, as well as our monthly newsletter, then called the Klan Action Report and later the Crusader. At the same time, Chloe and I were the sole managers of the daycare center we had started at Woodlawn Baptist Church, but luckily she did almost everything that the center needed. Sometimes when she was overwhelmed or had to run errands, I would go to the center and fill in. I loved to sit at the church's piano and make up stories for the children about knights and dragons and damsels, complete with sound effects from the creaky old upright. My stories and fairy tales were anything but politically correct, and I think that's one reason the kids enjoyed them so much. In my last semester in college, the spring of 1974, I had to earn 24 hours to graduate. To do so, I obtained permission from a professor and took a credit exam for a sociology course, which I passed easily. I also received permission from the dean to take more semester hours of coursework than usually allowed. In spite of my Klan activity, I completed the full 21 hours that semester with an A or a B in every subject. I had worked hard and looked forward to the graduation ceremony. Finally, I'd be able to pursue my life's work fully focused and full time. 2 weeks before graduation, I received an invitation, an air ticket, to a television talk show in Chicago that happened to fall on graduation day. I knew immediately to which event I would attend. My whole college career was about furthering the cause of our heritage, and I knew that I would further it more in Chicago than by attending my commencement exercises. That summer, I crisscrossed America and spoke at 2 or 3 meetings every week. In September of that year, a United States judge, Arthur Garrity, ordered the busing of thousands of white and black students in Boston, Massachusetts. The working-class neighborhood of Southie found many of its sons and daughters ordered to attend school in Roxbury, a drug and crime-filled area similar to Harlem, while numbers of blacks from Roxbury were to be bused to Southie. Some of the leaders of the anti-busing resistance in Southie had seen me on a television program weighing in against busing, so they invited me to come up and help organize the people of Boston. I sent 2 of our supporters to organize the Klan in the area. Immediately, I made a call in the press for Freedom Rides North, making a parody of rides that had descended upon the South in the civil rights days. I then flew up to Boston and was given a hero's welcome by the young men and women who were desperately fighting to save their neighborhood and the very lives and well-being of their children. The people of Boston, once the very heart of the abolitionist movement and the center from which the great attack was made on the South in the 1960s, now fought with all their might to resist integration. I saw the Boston resistance as the ultimate vindication of the South, and interestingly, the folks in Boston were on average a lot more radical than the ones in Mississippi and Louisiana. I had to continually explain to them that violence would only end up hurting their efforts. I told them how violence destroyed the resistance to integration in the South. Dr. Edward Fields, who was active in Birmingham with the National States Rights Party at the time, told me how thousands of whites had massed in the streets to oppose school integration. Then in the aftermath of the church bombing in 1963, they were all gone. I stressed that whites had to keep the moral imperative on our side. The truth is, I told them, it is the integrationists who are causing the loss of life, for they've already caused the loss of thousands of lives of white people and will cause the loss of many more thousands of European American lives in the cities of our nations. If we have our way, I told them, we will save the lives of both whites and blacks and our civilization as well. At one point, I joked with irony about the radicalism of the Boston people, saying to one of my organizers from Louisiana, "We've got to calm these people down. They want to kill all the Negroes while we just want to get them safely back to Africa." Back home, I soon learned the news that Chloe was pregnant. It was a wonderful moment for both of us when we discovered that we would bring a new life into the world. The unbroken chain that had brought together our two families was to add another link from the past to the future. It was difficult for Chloe, who had to contend with the daycare center and the Klan office work while she was pregnant, but she never complained. She was ecstatic over the thought of our first child. I began to be invited to increasing numbers of universities. I traveled to the University of North Carolina, UNC, at Chapel Hill for a speech on April the 4th, 1975. The speech had been scheduled in an old auditorium with about 2,000 seats. All were filled, and there were more than 500 students in an adjacent room hooked up to a public address system, and many others were outside the auditorium, crowded by the windows. Black students had picketed outside for about an hour before the speech, just before the start of my scheduled speech. About 100 militant blacks forced their way into the hall and lined up between the audience seating and the stage. They were screaming, jiving, blowing whistles, throwing objects, and doing anything they could to stop the speech. Because they were between the audience and me, the crowd could not hear anything of my introduction or of my opening remarks. Ironically, the blacks began to chant, "Freedom, freedom, freedom." They became more violent and unruly until the dean came to the microphone and called off the speech. That evening, I wrote a long letter to the university newspaper decrying the loss of freedom of speech at UNC. I was also able to show how the primitive behavior of the black students attempting to suppress freedom was reminiscent of the lack of freedom in black Africa. I warned that as the racial composition of America continued to grow darker, our freedoms would diminish further. In June, James Lindsay, my friend and father figure since my high school years, was killed. He was murdered the day before his divorce would become final, enabling his wife to inherit all his wealth. She was later charged with the homicide, but she had an excellent lawyer who won her an acquittal. News of his death struck me like a hammer, and I grieved hard for 3 days, hardly coming out of the house till I served as a pallbearer for his funeral in New Orleans. Chloe and I resolved to include his last name in the name of our first child. In 1975, I decided to make my first race for public office, a run for the Louisiana State Senate. My opponent was Ken Osterberger, a very popular Republican incumbent who, like most Republicans, was a decent conservative and a good family man, but he simply refused to address the critical issues facing the state and the nation. I ran pledging to fight the forced busing of the federal government, promising to work for legislation to end the discrimination against whites called affirmative action, to reform the welfare system, and to slow down the illegitimate welfare birth rate. As the youngest candidate in the state, I garnered 33% of the vote and greatly increased the public acceptability of the Klan. A month before Election Day, something occurred of much greater importance to Chloe and me than the election: the birth of our first child, our daughter, Erica. Like many expectant fathers, I had initially hoped that my first child would be a son. And when the doctor said that it was a girl, a tinge of disappointment touched me for a moment. But when I looked at her and held her in my arms, I was just thankful to God to have her and pleased that she was so perfect. We named her Erica Lindsay Duke. Gazing into her bright eyes, I saw the eyes of generations before me and the generations ahead. A year and a half later, Chloe and I were again blessed with another beautiful and healthy daughter, Kristen Chloe Duke, and she would prove in later years to be just as dedicated to the cause as I. I thought about how ironic it is that some people will deny race when it is in the very look of our children and in their spirit as they grow. Race is simply an extension of the family, a vital extension that will affect virtually every part of our children's lives. It is true that everyone is an individual, but the makeup, the racial makeup of a society, has an obviously profound impact on one's life and one's family. Race is not just found in the form of a child's face. It is found in the form of a society. If my children were to grow up in a non-white land, their likely opportunities for advancement and quality of life would be greatly lessened. However, their genes would give them inherent advantages wherever they were. It seems so strange to me that some people cannot see the elemental realities of race. Undoubtedly, one of the factors creating such a divorce from reality comes from thousands of TV shows and movies that portray the only difference between the races as their skin color. People don't think about the fact that in those dramas, both the white and black actors speak words almost always composed from the mind of a white person, the scriptwriter. The black actor simply parrots back feelings, values, and mores that come from a white writer, typically Jewish and liberal. No wonder the media makes the races seem so much more alike than their actual nature. Although I made many radio and television appearances, a great many were canceled at the last moment because of pressure from the ADL and other groups, and some programs taped for later airing were canceled after the interviewer did not do as well against me as he had planned. One of the top-rated and very well-spoken radio and television hosts in Los Angeles, the English-accented Jew Michael Jackson, invited me in his TV show and even sent me a plane ticket. On the air, he admitted and said that I had, quote, buried Tom Snyder, but he figured he could defeat me easily. First, we did the live radio show at midday, in which he did not fare too well, and then we went on to tape the TV show for its airing 2 days later. On the TV show, he came on very belligerently and began accusing me of being, quote, full of hate. He had used the hate argument earlier on the radio show, so I made some Xerox copies of some particularly hateful Talmudic quotations, as well as some very anti-Gentile quotations from the Jewish press. I don't hate blacks. I just want to live among my own people, according to my own values. But if you want to hear some hate, I'll give you some examples of hate. I began to quote Talmudic writ, such as, quote, the best of the Gentiles should be killed, unquote, and Gentiles are like unclean animals. I added, imagine if I said similar things about blacks and Jews. Jackson was speechless, dumbfounded that anyone would dare quote from the Talmud. The usually erudite talk show host stuttered and stumbled over his words as the show ended. He had a no-lose proposition, for if he had defeated me, he would have been anxious to broadcast the show. But because it was taped, he could avoid hurting his reputation by simply erasing the tape and airing another show. Jackson never allowed the program to be aired. In other appearances around the country, openly communist revolutionary organizations showed up and called for my death and urged physical attacks against me. Communist newspapers, such as the Progressive Labor Party, sported headlines that said, quote, "Death to Duke." In one radio station in Chicago, communists invaded with lead pipes, smashing the station and trying to strike me as I defended myself with a chair until the police finally expelled them from the facility. By 1977, I was speaking at about 100 meetings and doing 200 radio and television talk shows a year. As our organization grew, the authorities became more brazen in their attempts to intimidate and disrupt our movement. In 1975, we held a Klan convention in Metairie along with an international anti-communist conference. Participants came from around the world. Plainclothes officers in the hotel parking lot made a point of photographing guests, sometimes blinding them with flashes just inches from their faces. I asked them to leave and went to get the management of the hotel. During my absence, one of the delegates, a 78-year-old man, got into a scuffle with the police and was arrested. Some of the delegates berated and harangued the intelligence police, protesting the arrest. About 8 hours after the incident, they decided to arrest me on a misdemeanor charge of incitement to riot. Along with Dr. James K. Warner, head of the New Christian Crusade Church, I was found guilty by a kangaroo court, but the verdicts were later thrown out on appeal. Then the state dropped one of the charges so that I would not be entitled to a jury trial. Even though the evidence clearly exonerated me, Judge Thomas Wicker, in an incongruent verdict, found me guilty of inciting riot, but officially noted for the record that the, quote, riot caused no injury and no property damage. Some riot. A couple of years later, Wicker's wife received an appointment to a federal judgeship, as had the first judge in the first trial. You know, in the mid-1970s, I actively sought ways to publicly expose the threat to the nation's racial and cultural integrity from the massive illegal immigration pouring over the border from Mexico. Our leaders decided that a novel way to capitalize on the Klan notoriety would be to increase public awareness of the problem. We decided to launch a Klan border watch, that is, to have our members from California to Texas patrol the Mexican-American border and report illegal alien crossings to the undermanned U.S. Border Patrol. Of course, this was, I guess, almost 35 years earlier than the new border patrol the Minutemen have launched in America. We started things off with a tour of the San Ysidro port of entry in San Diego. The facility had given tours to the public at request, so I asked for one, and surprisingly, they accommodated me. The press was incensed that the leader of the KKK would be given a tour at a major government facility. The communists went ballistic. They arrived with their mestizo and Jewish minions to physically attack us. By the end of my tour, a sizable contingent of Marxists had launched a riot attacking the Border Patrol and us, a rampage through the facility throwing rocks and eggs. I remember one projectile hit a well-dressed Mexican woman who was coming through the customs checkpoint as a visitor. She lay on the ground as medics attended to her badly cut face. The police were finally able to end the melee, but it spawned many sensational newspaper stories and set the stage for our Klan Border Watch activity. Almost every newspaper in the United States, as well as every broadcasting network, covered the Klan Border Watch. In interviews, I stressed the alien threat to our American heritage. Many of the stories cast us in the worst possible light, some even suggesting that we would attack the Mexicans. But millions of Americans saw that at least a few people would stand up to the alien invasion, and that at least one organization saw the invasion as a crisis. The U.S. Border Patrol agents loved the fact that our Border Watch focused attention on the massive alien influx and even issued a public statement after my announcement of the Klan Border Watch saying that they would welcome information from any citizen on illegal border crossings. One of the politicians who attacked me the most was Mayor of San Diego at the time, Pete Wilson. Wilson sent a telegram to U.S. Attorney General Griffin Bell saying, quote, "I profoundly disagree with the attitude implied by local Border Patrol officials, which seems to condone the assistance of the notorious racist KKK," unquote. During that time, Wilson consistently downplayed the dangers of immigration and discounted the nefarious nature of affirmative action. Years later, however, he adopted my positions and used those same issues to propel himself to the California governorship. In an unexpected turn of events, we discovered that the Mexican newspapers and broadcast outlets had sensationalized our organization even more wildly than did the American press. Almost every Mexican newspaper ran front-page stories featuring the Klan Border Watch. Most of them boasted sinister-looking photographs of burning crosses and old turn-of-the-century stock photos of lynched Negroes. Some of the papers even used old photographs of the Christian ascetics in Spain with their peaked hoods and candles, labeling them as Klansmen. I show a number of these pictures, by the way, in my text in the book of My Awakening. Coinciding with the lurid headlines in Mexico, U.S. Border Patrol estimates of crossings by illegal aliens dropped dramatically, as apparently the would-be illegal aliens believed that hooded Klansmen waited for them on the American side of the border, nooses in hand. The only thing our Border Watch did was simply drive through the border areas and report locations of groups of illegal aliens heading north. Because of the supposed Klan threat to Mexicans, the Mexican government ordered its troops to patrol their side of the border, and to make sure no harm came to wetbacks on our side of the border, President Carter beefed up U.S. patrols. The Chronicle News Service reported the Border Patrol spokesman said the presence of troops must have accounted for decreased illegal alien activity during the weekend. He said only one illegal alien was encountered Saturday. The over-anxiousness of the press to paint us as dangerous people had inadvertently curtailed the alien flow for a few months. Another positive effect was that, because of the hype about the possible violence of Klan patrols, the state of California sent police there and urged local policing of the border areas. So in an effort to protect the aliens from the big bad Klan, the state actually ended up patrolling and protecting our American borders more than they would have. I became well versed in using the vast powers of the media against itself in a form of political jiu-jitsu, first pioneered by George Lincoln Rockwell. One of the most interesting and effective of my adventures during this period was a trip to Great Britain in 1978. Britain was experiencing massive third world immigration, much like the United States, and British patriots thought that my presence there could raise British consciousness of immigration in the same way that our Border Watch had done the same in the United States. Similar to immigration history in the United States, Jewish organizations play a dominant role in promoting British non-white immigration, and during a critical period of immigration, they were able to block all proposed laws for limiting the alien influx to the already densely populated island. By the time I had planned my trip to Britain, London was already beginning to experience a taste of the violent crime that plagues America's major cities, and the black crime rate in Britain is strikingly similar in proportion to that found in the United States, about 10 times higher per capita than white crime. Racially aware Britons had visited me in Louisiana and gone through the Klan ritual and returned home to set up dens in England and Scotland. They urged me to come to Britain in early 1978. I also had a standing invitation from some of the professors at Oxford to come and lecture to their classes on our view of the Reconstruction period and the dynamics of racial politics in the South. Some media had also expressed interest in interviews. The time was certainly right for me to go, but the problem was that the British government had banned me as politically undesirable. Still, I was determined to get in. I decided on a low-key strategy. After letting my beard grow for few days, I flew to New York and then flew standby on a flight to Britain on Laker Airlines. That way, the British government would have no warning of my arrival time. 7 hours later, I stood in front of the passport queue at British Customs, needing to make a decision. Five checkers were comparing the passport names against the prescribed list before granting the visitors entry visas. Three of them were spiffy English types, and the other two were black immigrants, plainly from the former British colonies in the West Indies. I decided to go directly to one of the black West Indians, thinking that they would be more likely to be less conscientious. I immediately smiled and said, "How you doing, man?" He laughed and lackadaisically failed to look at the prescribed list when he stamped my passport. Once my visa was stamped, I was in the country legally, despite being on the banned list at the border. I thought it apropos that I was able to be in the country to speak against immigration because of the incompetence of a non-white immigrant. I began meeting with our British Klan members as well as activists in the British National Front. We knew that my presence in Britain would create a great story in the sensationalistic British press. We decided that we would use the publicity to stress the immigration issue. I met with two reporters and the photographer from one of the largest daily papers, the Daily Mirror. I told them that I was Paul Revere in reverse, that I'd come to warn my British brothers and sisters about the dangers of multiculturalism and mass immigration. My late-hour clarion call was, "The Third World is coming. The Third World is coming." I pointed out that America is rife with racial problems and that Britain had a chance to avoid these terrors, keep their peace, and preserve their way of life, but that she needed to act soon. "Why is it," I asked, "that Britain and Europe always seem to copy the worst aspects of America rather than the best? Must your citizens and schools face the same ruin as ours, the same violence? Why must you repeat America's mistakes?" Immediately, the Home Secretary of the British government issued a deportation summons and issued my photograph to every policeman in the country. But through a series of intermediaries, I arranged interviews, radio programs, and appearances all over the nation. Adding to the mystique of the affair, BBC television did an interview from the back seat of a moving automobile. I posed in Klan robes with a view of Parliament and Big Ben in the background. I also appeared on the most watched television show in Britain, The Tonight Program. On the program, I recounted my Scottish and English heritage and made it plain how much I loved and respected the British homeland and my ancestors. I pointed out that the reason the government wanted to deport me was to keep me from telling the British people the truth about the failure of multiracialism in the United States. "Why is your government trying to keep out a visitor of British descent who's simply suggesting that you should preserve your wonderful nation, while the same government lets in millions who hate Britain and everything she stands for and allows them to live here?" Those were some of my words. After the show, I became instantly recognizable in London, and I did some walkabouts among the public. The British people treated me royally. Almost everyone who recognized me had something complimentary to say. The respected British newspaper, the Daily Telegraph, reported my success on the Tonight program as follows: "Such was Mr. Duke's aplomb in handling the surly aggression of the Tonight program interviewer, millions of Britons may be forgiven for thinking that there is something to be said for the Ku Klux Klan after all." A real cat and mouse game developed between Scotland Yard and me. In the Cunard Hotel lobby, while in the midst of an interview with a reporter, I could see through the large hotel windows the police storming through one of the doors. I jump ahead of them as they came up the 50-foot escalator. I went down the other side, waving and smiling, and dashed into the street to a waiting car. The next day, newspaper headlines read, "Grand Wizard Does Vanishing Act," and "Bobby's in Keystone Cops Fiasco with Klan Leader." Many of the papers dubbed me as the Klan's Scarlet Pimpernel, a positive reference to the legendary Englishman who rescued many of the French aristocracy from the terrors of the French Revolution. He was known for his disguises and elusiveness. I kept on speaking and traveling for about 2 weeks and avoided capture, despite front-page stories every day in almost all the major newspapers. It became a bigger story with each passing day. The event went on to capture the imagination of the British people, who, whether or not they agreed with me, rooted for me as they would a fox running from the hounds. The British people touched my heart as well, and I fully realized that they, as much as the American people, were overwhelmingly opposed to Third World immigration. But just as in America, the Jewish enemies of their heritage controlled both media and the politicians, so nothing was done to halt the onrushing catastrophe. Today, many parts of London resemble more the Middle East than the Britain of old. The British people, much like we Americans, are now blessed by what the media call the joys of diversity. It is difficult to understand how escalating crime and drugs, overburdened welfare rolls, high taxes, and failed schools are so joyful. Even when I was addressing large crowds, the people would not give me up to the authorities. At Oxford University, I lectured to 200 students and faculty and left shortly before the police arrived. A farmer named Beauclerc of the Red Ascot Farm hosted a cross-lighting ceremony for me in the countryside. A massive traffic jam occurred because of people trying to attend the rally in spite of the police roadblocks. I stayed away, but the next night I went to the Red Ascot Farm and we held another one. I did a radio program at a studio in East London, and when the police arrived, I escaped through a side door. In response to these events, the headlines read, "Klansmen still not run to ground." The newspapers also played on the House Secretary's first name, Merlin, and continually referred to Merlin and the Wizard. Many poems were written and published about the affair. Hundreds of political cartoons were published, which were entertaining and sometimes quite effective for our issues. One cartoon, for instance, showed a line of immigrants at the welfare office and a rogue Klansman talking with the officer saying, "I've been here for so long, surely I'm entitled to something." It was all great fun. The plaintive words of the lead editorial in the Mirror sum up the circus atmosphere of the affair. Quote, "Mr. Duke is a smooth, plausible spokesman, the best imitation the Klan's ever had of a good guy." The New Statesman ran a cartoon and a poem showing the carnival atmosphere of the cat and mouse game I played with the government. Here it is. "Sing a song of watchdogs hoping for a fluke, 20,000 policemen hunting David Duke. Catch a clever Klansman, wrap him in a sheet. You'll find him in a public house or posing in the street. Nobody could trace him, not for love or money. Jardine called it farcical, but no one found it funny. Now that he's been cornered, we praise our smart police, but most of all, the wizard's wand should go to Merlin Reese." One afternoon, while all of Scotland Yard searched for me, I sat in the ABC Evening News European office on Fleet Street, the media center, and did an interview with Peter Jennings for that evening's broadcast. Afterward, we had an excellent visit for an hour over tea and cakes. We had a frank discussion, sympathetic to the plight of the Palestinians. Jennings was one of the few higher-ups in the media who understood the Zionist injustice in Palestine. He had been assigned once to the Mideast Bureau for ABC. While on Fleet Street, I also met with an Associated Press reporter I had befriended. From his office, I watched the photos he had taken of me in front of Big Ben go to the major cities and newspapers around the world. Moscow, New York, Prague, Peking, Buenos Aires, even remote nations such as Nepal and Borneo. I knew that every bit of publicity would ultimately be more opportunity to get the truth of race to our people. I kept on doing radio programs by phone from different locations, asking the British people why the government was so anxious to shut down and shut up me about the immigration issue, I emphasized that the real question was not really my right of free speech, but their right to hear a dissenting view on this vital question. To make light of the whole affair, while being hunted, I posed for photographs with the beefeaters at the Tower of London, and actually had a photograph taken by my AP friend right beneath the revolving Scotland Yard sign in the street in front of their headquarters in London. I spoke at some British National Front meetings, and the reception to my speeches was ecstatic. The audiences were especially pleased that the British people were hearing from one American who didn't sing the praises of racial integration. Government agents finally apprehended me through a treacherous reporter who sold me out for the big story. The authorities caught up with me in a pub appropriately named The Fox and the Hounds. Both the reporter and I had mustaches, and true to the bureaucratic incompetence existing in every nation, the agents mistook the reporter for me, the lead agent, as if reading from a script said, "Well, Mr. Duke, you have led us on a merry chase, but we have now finally caught up with you," and then handed the reporter the summons. In a poor imitation of a British accent, I mumbled something about filing the story and actually made it out of the pub while the reporter comedically tried to tell the Home Office undersecretary that they had the wrong man. I started away in the darkness behind the pub, but they caught up with me after only five doors from the safety of a home of a supporter. The papers reported that I had appropriately had said, quote, "God save Britain and the Queen," upon their giving me the summons. My friends engaged a good solicitor, and I was able to stay a few more days and make considerable numbers of appearances before I had to get back to my pressing Klan activities in the United States. I viewed the British trip as successful because it made people confront the immigration issue. It even had an impact in America because dozens of national wire stories, many TV news stories, and a full-page article in Newsweek were the result of it. Furthermore, it enhanced the Klan's image, for it became tough to portray the Klan as a bunch of ignorant Southerners when its leader found so much popular support in Britain. My public appearances began to build a more positive image for the Klan. Some in the media grudgingly noted that my group, the Knights of the Ku Klux Klan, was not nonviolent and law-abiding, that our leadership was educated and articulate, that ours was the only Klan group in which women could fully participate, and that we were predominantly a movement of younger people. Ben Bradley Jr., the son of the famous Ben Bradley, the Washington Post, wrote an excellent series of articles in our organization for the Los Angeles Times called, quote, "The New Klan," some of the fairest pieces that I've ever seen. The Klan was bucking against the tide of its liberal media bias, but we began to get some decent publicity from the honest reporters and editors still left in the business. We made significant headway. But as we continued to make breakthroughs, the ADL and the government became increasingly worried. A Klan made up of a few good old boys letting off steam on a Saturday night, they could handle that, but they certainly did not want to see the beginnings of a serious mass movement. A politically oriented Klan with an effective spokesman, that just wouldn't do. The ADL began an extreme attack on my organization and me. They mailed poison pen information packets on me to every reporter, every possible editor in both print media and broadcasting. They warned about giving me publicity, and they subtly let media outlets know that anything less than caustically condemning me was practically equivalent to condoning the Holocaust. The press began to reach new levels of viciousness. In the late 1970s, one prominent Jewish journalist even wrote a novel based on my character called The Grand Dragon. The next chapter is chapter 38, The Grand Dragon and the Jewish Psyche.